we're here at This Week on Channel 9. I'm Dan Fernandez.
I'm Ed Keim.
And you are playing the part of Brian Keller today.
Absolutely.
I don't know where Brian is, but I'm sure he's on a beach somewhere.
If anybody has seen Brian, can you please call the number at the bottom of your screen right now?
The only thing we have is a bloody shoe, so I can only assume he's fine.
He has done this before, though.
Yeah, he loves leaving bloody
shoes.
Remember
Tech Ed 2003?
Oh, yeah.
It was like three bloody shoes. It was awesome.
It's terrible. Poor cleaning lady. So, news! Well, let's get into it. Yeah, so Windows Live, guys, keep doing stuff. So this is from dev.live.com. Actually, you want to talk about this one?
Well, yeah, I think it's a great testament to the work that the Windows Live team is doing right now, because all these major social networks and other just fabric-type internet properties are getting on the Windows
fabric?
Live bandwagon. Yeah, well, you know, the internet's becoming more and more of a fabric-based
textile, yeah,
world.
It's definitely.
Well, it's much less standalone applications. Now software really has to integrate well, and Windows Live is providing a great amount of glue and a great amount of
the term is social
content.
Graph, baby.
No.
I know. Yeah, so Facebook.
I'm going to lose Facebook friends because of that. You just
Facebook is on here. LinkedIn is on here. So, like, the two services that I use on a regular basis are on here.
And there's some
really
more coming soon. I don't think that they're out yet, but some of the other guys, like High Five and Bebo, are on the way, which is going to be cool because in the U.S., I mean, Facebook's pretty huge, but worldwide, there's a ton of different networks that have their own strongholds throughout different geographies. And fortunately, the one common thing from a Microsoft perspective is that Windows Live has got great inroads in all these places. And, you know,
Yeah, so there's like 500 million or so Windows Live contacts. So imagine you're on Facebook and you say, hey, type in your Windows Live ID. And what I can do is find if your friends are already on Facebook. And that way you can become friends and see which one of your friends are actually on the service already. So it's a really nice thing for Facebook in that they actually connect the dots for their social network or Tagged or High Five or Bebo or all these. And before, what they were doing before is like literally doing an authentication to your Hotmail and then doing screen scraping. This is much easier for them to implement, and it's safe, obviously.
Yeah, and there's some two-way stuff, too. There's also ways to get relationships you have in some of these social networks into your central Windows Live data store. And that's going to lead to better experiences down the road for people when they start bringing applications together that use different features of Windows Live. And so lots of cool stuff coming from there, and there's even more soon. So
yeah, data portability is hot. So cool stuff. Congrats to the Windows Live team.
ASP.NET MVC source control is the source code rather is now available, which is great. This was something that was promised, and now it can be done. And one of the things that a lot of people might not realize is the ability to patch.
Mm-hmm.
So you can take that, you can build your own branch of it. You can patch things if you find issues, or if you want to add your own small features and stuff, and extend it. And that's just so cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, you talk about evolution of Microsoft. We released all the source code where you could source code debug into the framework. Now we're literally releasing the source code of MVC where you can actually patch it. Now, one of the restrictions, obviously, in the license is that you can't redistribute it, so you can't have, like, 30 different flavors of ASP.NET MVC floating around. But this is awesome. So, like, I see it as just, like, another example of how we're opening up more and more.
Yeah, and it's great for developers, and that's really what's important here, just making their lives easier.
So and lots of tutorials linked to on Scott's blog. So, all right. So I got to talk about this one because this is a old team. So this is Doug Handler, Jacqueline, and I had this idea of actually bringing Silverlight into Visual Studio Express. So we redid the Visual Studio Express site, and one of the coolest parts is that it has an interactive product tours, and that's all built in Silverlight. So it's like. We'll pull up a clip, actually, while we're doing this. But, like, there's hotspots, and you click on the hotspot, and then you get the information about the feature. So, like, before this was, if you look at, like, the classic MSDN, like, a before and after, you just see, like, the massive difference in what you can do from a user experience. So somebody that's never used the product before wants to know about what are the interesting features of Visual Studio. And it's all there on a per-product basis. So you can see the design features, IDE features, how to share your web page, all that good stuff. So, cool stuff.
Yeah, and also then you can go download it for free, use it however you want to.
Yeah.
So it's really low touch, which is great. People don't even have to pull it down before they can see what it does, and that's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Now, a video that Charles had put up this week was John Lamb and Martin Mallet talking about Deep DLR. So this is the dynamic language runtime. And what they actually do is whiteboard it. And this video clip is actually Martin showing how some code in Iron Python is then translated to work in the dynamic language runtime. So let's go to the clip.
The class body, from Python's perspective, is just some code that it gets executed and fills in a dictionary. So at the end, after this gets executed, there will be a dictionary with foo in it, which points to Python method. Which then has this code in it, the printx. So how does this all get built? When the Python parses this thing, it builds its own AST, which is some kind of class C thing, which is a body with a bunch of statements. One of them is def statement, which also has a body with a bunch of statements. One of them is printx. So then Python does that, and only Python can decide what the language syntax is, and Python did. It's actually fairly well spec'd, okay, given that it's fairly new language, unlike Ruby. And so where do you go from here? Right? Something at the end is going to be DLR receiving end. So what Python does, it's going to transform this syntax tree into what we call DLR tree. If you play with link expressions, these won't be too foreign to you, except the link expressions really represent only expressions, whereas these guys represent also statements, because we have to represent real languages in here, not just expression subset of languages. So just this function, for example, would look like, on the DLR side, like code block, which takes two args. One is called self and is an object. The other one is an x and also is an object. And the print statement would be, it's also part of Python's definition, but DLR doesn't know anything about a print statement, so DLR, on the DLR side, Python would choose to express it as some call to Python ops.print. And print that. Maybe just reference to the variable.
Okay. So some pretty interesting things that they're doing there on the to translate this stuff into DLR trees, which are similar to expression trees. But Martin Mallet is the LOL code guy.
Yes. Yeah, I hear so. That's the new C sharp.
Yeah. I'm coding everything. I went from Ook sharp to LOL code. So it's it's been a crazy conversation.
I'm always a big fan of any cat-based programming language. And in this case, low code is just awesome.
Yeah.
And the thing about DLR, though, from a more serious side, is it's really interesting to see what's happening here, because dynamic languages are fundamentally different than more static languages. And yet the features you get from them, they lead into new opportunities for developers to be more productive and have code that's easier to write and maintain. But the main challenge that Microsoft has is worrying about the learning curve, because you don't want to leave a bunch of people behind and not enable that. So the consistency that's being built in and the way it's being made so that, you know, you can have a very familiar environment where you're able to take advantage of these new features without having to completely relearn programming is important. Because I think without doing that, people wouldn't even look into it. They'd say, I know C# or VB or C++, I'm not going to care. But now you can kind of very gradually add it into your toolbox and become a more productive developer as a result.
Yeah. So it's pretty interesting to see, and always good to see John Lamb and Martin Mallet. So cool stuff, Charles. So this is, speaking of DLR, this is Giles Thomas.
The Iron Python spreadsheet.
Yeah, so speaking of real-world shipping products that are using dynamic languages like Python. So what this spreadsheet does, and we'll actually take a clip in a minute, is it lets you... effectively, you're writing in a spreadsheet, and it does the automatic generation of the Iron Python code. And because it's all Iron Python, this is like for the real power users who want to do stuff. You can call in .NET classes, and that's what this clip is.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at the clip.
Right. I want to import from TextCalc. I want to import my text breakdown. We're also working on a GUI for that bit as well. But
okay, so TextCalc is the DLL, and I guess AddReference it knows because of the specific folder you put it in. And now now when you say I'm importing that, what exactly is that doing?
In Python, you have to specifically, well, you normally, if you're writing precise Python code, you specify which objects you're importing from a particular namespace, from a particular assembly.
Okay.
So in this case, I'm saying that I want to import the tax breakdown object from the TaxCalc assembly. That's
okay.
What it is. So, what I can do now is just create an instance of that in the grid using regular formula syntax. So I'll just do a tax breakdown. Now, Python doesn't require new or anything like that. You just say the name of the object in bracket.
Okay.
And I'll say paper. And that price. So I've entered a... literally
so now that DLL is effectively the same thing as a spreadsheet function.
Yeah, the class is inside the...
or at least the way the user is going to use it in the spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. He's just typing the name and passing in parameters.
That's right.
So that was a pretty cool clip about some of the Iron Python stuff. But switching gears a little bit, I wanted to talk about some of the neat things that are coming around with Xbox Live and the Xbox Live Arcade.
Yeah.
And one of the cool uses that's come out over this past week, or at least you know I've learned about, is the P2P user-generated content stuff that's really taken off. The idea that you can now build things and share them among different people, whether it's maps for games or other things like that, and all that stuff stored locally, so you don't have to worry about having server-side storage or integrating with any kind of backend. And it's going to be pretty cool in that you can, like, for example, you and I could get together to play a game, and I might have my own map that I built, and we could try it out together. And
right.
I don't have to tell you where anything's hidden and finally beat you in a game.
Yeah, I just don't want you to yell at me at Halo again, but that's a different story that
I
still...
Do you think we... Yeah, well, about. I told you, you gotta plant the bomb, all right?
So the reason why this is cool is you think about all these games and the extensibility, like literally on Xbox where I can now share maps or you know, I can think about the race car game where I skin my car and then I can send the skin over to you. So there's just a lot of cool things that really sort of been inherited from the PC world are now available directly in Xbox Live Arcade, and the people that are building the games don't have to implement anything special. They're just using the Xbox Live services to be able to do now peer-to-peer user-generated content. So some pretty cool stuff.
Today we actually launched N+, a brand new game on our arcade service, an existing PC game, and it's our first game with a level editor and allowing peer-to-peer sharing of those levels. So you, the average user, can create your own level and share it with your friends.
Yes.
That's an innovation that's happened on our game.
That's really cool, and it kind of gets back to some of the more general trends that we're seeing in computing, which is user-generated content. So now, you know, me and my friends can share different maps and it's sharing peer-to-peer, and you mentioned some of the issues around client-to-server sharing and some of the things like permissions and, or I should say, content ruling and all that, those issues that people want to avoid by just doing peer-to-peer. So what's when you mentioned user-generated content, you're actually building a map.
Yes.
Right? So you enable the casual user to actually build the map and then share it with their friends over, and I'm like literally sending them the file, and
yes,
now we can play co-op.
Yes.
Awesome.
We can play co-op competitively, whatever you want to, but any user can create a level and share it with their friends, and they have that whole community aspect of it. And a lot of the levels that are in the current version of N+ that we ship today on Arcade were levels that were created by the community on the PC version of the map editor.
Okay, so the next cool thing going on was a guy named James Newton King published a JSON project. And what this allows you to do is call JSON services, which is JavaScript
Object Notation.
And what it allows you to do is...
Well, what it allows you to do is to download JSON API result calls, so the JSON data itself, and then convert it into .NET objects. So if you had a remote service from pretty much any JSON provider, you'd be able to call into the API, get the JSON back, and then deserialize it into a strongly typed .NET class. And that's useful in so many scenarios.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people that are building JSON APIs, and one of the advantages is a guy named R. Tyler Balance, who was talking about some of the Facebook APIs, is the performance. So he did some tests, regular XML versus JSON calls, and the performance is about 200% faster just because the XML is so much more verbose. You have to parse it. So having a nice, simple library that says, hey, there's this JSON object, convert it into a .NET object so I can use is super handy. So nice...
Cool. And also, if you're using WCF on the back end, it really doesn't matter from the original source provider, because you can expose stuff through JSON, you can expose it through SOAP, you can expose it through pretty much any number of endpoints. So the flexibility this adds is great, because whether you're doing proxying or if you're going from a Windows Forms application, that just puts another item in your toolbox, makes it easy to use.
Ed and I were talking about proxies, arguing about that later. So... So here's the quick example actually showing, you know, I build a new product, I serialize it, and then I deserialize it. So some pretty simple script to be able to use and very, very lightweight. I'm ready to use this like
See
today.
The problem I had is I don't think this code is useful. But you were saying that
Yeah, you never want to deserialize JavaScript objects into C sharp.
Well, I just don't think it's useful to deserialize serialize to a string and then deserialize it to an object. Why don't you just use the object you created? That's where we had the big debate.
That was... Okay, moving right along.
You're going to edit that later on. It's going to make me seem like I don't know what I'm talking about.
Oh, without a doubt.
All right, fine. Then I'm taking this one. WPF wizard dialog.
As you should, sure.
Some folks might have noticed that in the .NET framework, specifically Windows Forms, there wasn't really a wizard dialog. And if you came from an MFC background or even really just, I mean, Win32, as far back as I can recall, had something, you know, you could flip a bit and get a wizard-style dialog if you were dealing with something that was a procedural process. This is back now in WPF as part of a CodePlex project to make it easier for people to build those step-by-step procedural processes into their applications. And I think that wizards are great, and I'm kind of missed that from Windows Forms applications, that they had to be written by hand. It just seemed like there was so much more work to do it. And now
we have actually
easy.
Covered in this show a Windows Form wizard control builder.
I don't watch the shows I'm not on.
Oh.
Sorry, man.
Awkward. Wrong. So this is a WPF version of that wizard. Actually, it's not of the same wizard, but because the previous one had designer-generated stuff. But this is cool to do because wizards have some pretty neat features, and it shows you the API, the classic things like accepting a EULA and license and all that. It's just built in. So moving
UI
right
patterns up. As a good, great segue into UI patterns in general. There's a...
Of course.
The UI design pattern library that's available at uipatterns.com. There's just so many different things people do on a regular basis.
Recreating the wheel every time.
Yeah. And ASP.NET did so much to get people further along when membership was introduced and stuff with roles and the other kind of providers. And this just takes that to the next level in that it gives you better practical guidance on using those features and implementing the stuff that isn't built in yet.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I'm going to build a website. I know I'm going to have these sort of common things. Rather, see how other sites are doing it. So the thing that I really like about this is let's say, input feedback. It'll give you five different websites that do input feedback design patterns. So you can be like, oh, you know, I really like Amazon's approach, or Amazon's approach sucks. I'd rather like the Flickr approach that gives you dynamic, like, as you type input feedback, for example. So some pretty cool stuff. If you're building... UI, definitely check this out. Couldn't come sooner enough.
Pick of the week. It means we're almost done.
Yeah, baby. So this is a handy piece of software that allows you to, it wraps the the Vista Image Mastering API, which actually I think they call IMAPI. And this is IMAPI 2, so it's the update. It's only Vista, but it allows you to burn CDs and DVDs, which is really nice when you need to have your own code to be able to do that. And it supports a bunch of stuff, and it's all written in .NET code, so you can use it in VB and C#. So, and the example actually includes a DVD burner. So all that like freeware that you end up burning for something, and you were talking about some utility that actually exists.
Yeah, I love the Windows Server Resource Kit. I don't recall exactly where the download's from. It's somewhere off the Microsoft site, but there's all these utilities in there, and there's a CD burn and a DVD burn, and they're not really designed to be super flexible. You just take an ISO, and you can point it at an ISO and a drive, and it'll just burn it for you. And that's what I use a lot, because I'll be on a machine randomly and I'll just need to be able to burn something real quick, and it's handy. But if you want the flexibility to be able to really name stuff and to do all the detailed stuff, this is the way to go.
Yeah, so pretty cool stuff. My pick of the week.
Very nice pick.
So let's talk about your pick of the week.
So my pick of the week is some of the cool stuff coming out of the Silverlight streaming team. What they've actually done is they've expanded Mix, for example. They expanded the quality that you can stream videos at, as well as the storage size people have and all this stuff.
Talked about it last week.
Yeah. And the story gets better and better, because now there's a pilot for an ads program where if you happen to store media up there, specifically videos, you can now get context-sensitive video ads served, or rather context-sensitive ads. I shouldn't say video ads, but context-sensitive ads that are served along with your video. And not only are these available to make your service free, but you also get a cut of the revenue. So we're getting to a point now where Microsoft is going to be paying people if they're able to get lots of videos up there and their own services. So you can have your third-party site host videos people are uploading and then make money off of that just through Microsoft alone, as long as you are able to pull in the users and the eyeballs.
All right, so we take our nine guy, we throw him in a catapult and then launch a parachute so he lands safely. Million people watch it. I could actually make money on that. That's what you're telling me.
This thing is 200 pounds.
The thing is 200 pounds, but it's going to be a hell of a catapult. So basically, I have my viral video.
Yep.
And now I can make money off of it.
Yeah, and you don't have to pay for things like the storage of it, the streaming of it. I mean, all the costs, I mean, all the benefits of Silverlight streaming are still there. And now you can potentially make money. And
this is a pilot program, though.
Yeah.
But
and they're starting off small. Cool. I mean, you can get out to the site, and we don't have the URL up there. We'll add that on the video page.
Yeah, maybe.
But you'll be able to get out there, sign up. They're starting out with a small group. They're going to expand it as the feature set gets more and more locked. But I really recommend, if you have a cool video scenario and you don't want to pay for storage and streaming, why not get paid for your videos in this way as well?
Cool. All right. So that wraps up another show. Any closing arguments?
No, this is probably the longest we've gone without getting into like a physical fight. So
actually is. So thanks, Ed, for being our guest, and see y'all later. Yeah, serializing an object and then deserializing it is pointless. Yeah. I agree.
Okay, so maybe that one I tried to trap you on.
I hope we're still recording this, because I'm going to...